Hello there, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of season 3. Psyched to be with you. Today, I'm joined by Irma Milunovic. Irma is another one of my fantastic colleagues, and more importantly, friends, also looking at the psychology research. However, this time, we're going to be talking about investigative interviewing and personality in the relation to forensic psychology. So we're going to be getting our criminal minds on. That's a play on the TV show of the same name, and forensic psychology being the study of the criminal mind. So you see how that joke worked out. Excellent. In this episode, we delve into sort of talking about being an international student. We talk about changes in career through progression, which is something Irma can speak to really excellently. We also talk about reading and sort of like some really good pearls of wisdom there, board games, and then there's a huge section on TTRPGs because I'm very lucky enough to roll dice with Irma. So you'll hear all this and much more. I mean, listen, this is really fun. It's another great episode, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here's the episode. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to be with you. Episode 4, because I forget what month it is. I do these in advance, usually, of season 3 at this point. Yeah, we're cracking on. We're doing lots of the podcast, which we love to see. This is going to be another cracking episode coming in hot for you as I sit down with yet another famous face, wonderful guest, and someone I'm privileged to call a friend as well as a colleague. So this is going to be a good one. Yet more wonderful accents being added to the show, which fills my heart with joy. So, yeah, without further ado, let's get into it. My very special guest, if you could please introduce yourself, tell us who you are and what you do.
Hello, hello. Glad to be here with you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me to your show.
Are you psyched to be with me?
I am very psyched to be here and with you. Amazing. I did it. So, I'm Irma, and I'm currently doing my PhD at the same university as Chris is doing at Edge Hill University, and I'm doing it in psychology with the focus on investigative interviewing and personality. So, that's where I'm up right now. I'm in my third year, hopefully going to be done sometime next year, fingers crossed. But yeah, here we go.
Okay, excellent. For the sake of people who've clicked on the episode or are watching it at home, and definitely not myself, can you pronounce your surname for us?
Yes, of course. So the way I would actually pronounce it, my full name, as if I would do it in my language, which is Bosnian, would be Irma Milunovic. But I always allow people to go a little bit, you know, sideways with it. So Irma Milunovic, whatever, however you want to call me, I'll answer. If it's interesting.
Okay, excellent. Definitely not going to use that any edit to try and pronounce that properly for the closed open on the audio version. Definitely not.
Shortening it down to Mel also works. It has a nice ring to it anyways.
It makes Mel sound so much more British.
Exactly. There you go. Assimilating to the culture.
So you're also doing a PhD. That's excellent. You're looking at some really cool stuff in the sort of forensic psychology ballpark. One of the things I always like to do, sort of the premise of the show, is how did you sort of end up on this path?
Okay, it's a bit of a long-winded answer for me here.
That's why it's a podcast.
Exactly. I'll tell you the journey. But basically, obviously, I've just mentioned I'm from Bosnia, so I started my secondary education, high school in Bosnia. And growing up in Bosnia, usually how it works is that if you want to succeed well in life, you have a couple of sort of careers that you go into, and those are medicine or engineering or law or something like that. So growing up, I really wanted to do medicine. So the fact that I'm here doing PhD in forensic psychology, if I told this to, I don't know, 10-year-old myself, her mind would probably explode. So I started my university degree in Canada, in Vancouver at University of British Columbia. And the whole idea was to go into med school. However, that's difficult to do, very expensive. So I ended up studying neuroscience. And I love neuroscience and I love studying brain and things like that. However, I realized while I was studying the neuroscience in my degree, I didn't like working with rats. I loved working with rats, but I didn't like the sort of side effects of having to, you know, deal with the brains of rats and mice and things like that. So I decided the behavior neuroscience is probably not the best for me. And it happened that at the same time, I took an elective in forensic psychology and absolutely loved it to the extent that I spent my free time studying for it, which has never happened before and hasn't happened since. But here we go. So I really loved forensic psychology. So then decided after I finished my bachelor's to try and get my master's in forensic psychology. But true to be honest, it always felt a little bit like an unattainable dream for me because, again, growing up home, we didn't have forensic psychology offered to begin with. Even to this day, when I try to explain people what I'm studying, it's quite difficult because it's not a thing that really exists super heavily back home. Obviously, there's branches and there's things and people working in the field, but there is no really degree or university that you can go to get that. So there we go.
Well, I very much resonate with that on a level because my undergraduate degree was forensic psych and criminal justice. And you'd say to people, oh, I'm doing forensic psychology. And they'd go, like CSI.
Exactly. I had this exact same conversation 2 days ago. I met up with one of my childhood best friends that I haven't seen in years because I'm visiting Germany at the moment. And she was telling me, is like, yeah, I tell everybody that my friend is working like the CSI forensic stuff. I'm like, what? No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm doing forensic psychology, which is completely different for forensic science. But I did actually, funnily enough, I did apply for forensic science master in Amsterdam University for my master's degree as well. Just if I can do forensic psychology, then I decided to stick with biology, just do it over like biology, like life sciences, but do it from forensic science point of view. And I did get in, but I decided to go for the forensic psychology instead.
So medicine, nah, neuroscience, brains good, rats experimental bad.
Not good.
Criminal Minds, another TV show reference. Forensic science.
There we go.
Yes, we stuck with that. PhD?
Who knows? You tell me. But yes, basically that's how it is. That's how it is. And listen, I've always loved learning for some reason, always loved school. I love the idea of being an internal student. And I say this with a sarcastic
not at all relatable on this show.
Not at all relatable, but no, I am kind of done with it now. So I'm just, you know, very excited to be done with it. But back like, 4 or 5 years ago, when I was planning my future in that sense, I did want to, you know, continue being suited for a little while just because I felt like there was more to do and more to learn before I can actually be let out in the world, unleashed.
For listeners, let out was surrounded by finger quotes. Okay, so what I'd really like to know is before we talk about the PhD in of itself, obviously, like you said, you had this plan. What was it like adapting to those changes? Because I think I've worked in outreach and stuff, and we talk a lot about like aspirations and attainment. Mm-hmm. It can be difficult when you change course. How did you kind of navigate that? Particularly when, you know, you mentioned that if you told 10-year-old you that you were going to depart from this career of medicine, like how did that feel? Especially when you were so far from home.
Yeah, it was very challenging at first. And I mean, it still is to this day. And again, I go back with the how I was brought up by myself and not so much by my family, but like the society I was in. It was like, you're kind of set on this one path. And if you don't do it, you're kind of a failure in that sense. So the fact that I decided to not do medicine in the end, and for a number of different reasons, it's not just because it was very difficult to do it in a foreign country and to do it because it was expensive and things like that. You would really have to, you know, work super hard for it. Even then, it probably might be impossible for me as a foreign citizen when I was back in Canada. It wasn't just that. It was also the fact that I really liked forensic psychology. But like I said, it always felt a bit unattainable to me. It always felt a little bit like a fever dream in a way that I didn't really expect myself to ever be able to reach that. So when it did happen, I was super excited, obviously, and I did that. But it was a bit of a challenge sort of adapting to the idea. I'm not doing STEM in a sense. Like I'm doing STEM, but it's, you know, more of a, I don't know how we define psychology. Is it more of a social science or is it like, you know, things like that? But I was more about, I will do like hard sciences in that sense to medicine, physics, biology, things like that. And then I shifted to more social science. So that was a bit of a challenge for me at first because I didn't envision myself in that field. But as soon as I actually started getting into it and started learning and obviously realizing that I'm actually loving what I'm studying and what I'm learning. And when I started working or I guess doing my internship for a year in the field of forensic science, forensic psychology, even though I'm not a morning person, I had no problem waking up at 6 a.m. every day to go to work because I was actually genuinely excited to go to work. And that's when I knew, well, this worked out for me in that sense.
Okay, so firstly, I'd like to touch on that. You kind of opened up the big psychology chestnut there of is psychology a science? My joke is, if you're not doing it properly, then it's not. And if you are, it is.
Of course.
Because
of
have
course.
You seen psychology?
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's the thing. I mean, a whole 3 years of our life is just pure research all the time. So people who don't say it's science to me sound super silly. But it's just about to what level, you know, it's a very different way of studying than you would with biology, genetics, forensic science and things like that. It's still science, just very different way of doing it. But again, adapting to that change was slightly challenging at first. But also because I didn't know if I was making a mistake because I lived in Canada for 4 years. I did my whole neuroscience degree and I really loved it. And I really kind of accepted the idea, oh, I'm studying neuroscience and I'm going to continue with this and I'm going to do cognitive neuroscience. And then suddenly I got this opportunity to go to Netherlands, which is where I did my master's degree, which meant, again, leaving Canada, where I really felt like I was, it was home for me. Even I only spent 4 years there. I've really made great friends that considered second family. I love the city. I love my environment. I loved everything. And I've really felt comfortable for the first time probably in my life. I felt comfortable at home as well. But this is where I really felt accepted in that sense. And then to leave all of that to pursue a career slash a degree that I've never even considered to, you know, to a certain extent before was quite a big step to take. But I did it and I didn't regret it. I do miss Canada as a country to live in. But I do not regret the decision to go with this degree rather than staying in neuroscience.
So out of interest then, I do have a joke I was going to make, but that was quite sincere, so I don't want to do it after that.
Do it! I love the jokes. We love jokes. Come on.
I was going to be like, so desperately seeking approval from others and your childhood self, and what's why you're doing a PhD? Not relatable.
Not relatable at all.
Called out. I call myself out on my own podcast. It happens. But so out of interest, though, one thing I'd like to probe here is how did you find going into psychology from neuroscience? Because, you know, even when you see, you know, we see undergraduates, we teach them what they learn at A level, sort of, you know, before degree level, is really quite a shock and quite different in many ways. And then, like, you see that step again when you go to master's. What was going into a master's like without having any foundational knowledge in psychology specifically?
Well, to be fair, how my degree was developed is that I actually did get quite a good psychology background and foundation in that sense. So the way it worked in my undergrad, I started my degree in the Faculty of Science. So that means in my first year, I had to do calculus and physics and chemistry and biology, all those sorts of things. And then from second year, you declare your major and then you pick your sort of, you have some, you know, mandatory courses you have to take and then some electives. And with those electives, there was a lot of psychology subjects. So I did take a lot of psychology and I had a really good A-level psychology as well because I did IB in my high school. So I will say that I went into my master's degree having quite a good basis in psychology. But actually, to flip that question around, I feel because I did my undergrad in neuroscience, I actually felt more prepared for master's and PhD because doing undergrad in sciences is not the easiest thing in the world, especially in the first year when you have two math, two physics, two chemistries, two biologies, all of these sort of courses at the same time. So the fact that I was able to do that and then going into master's, but already when I'm more mature and, you know, more able to organize my time and structure my day, I felt actually much more prepared than I would have other way around, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. I think maybe as well it's worth pointing out for international listeners, the way higher education is structured is quite different depending on where you are in the world. Like the UK, I think, I don't know neuroscience degrees, but I feel like that would definitely lean much more towards the biology side here. And I don't think it would maybe have as much psychology stuff here. So it's interesting that you had that as an option, as well as all the, as you might put it, hardcore, finger quotes, science.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was the thing. It was kind of like split in a way. There was a lot of those, like, you know, biology courses we had to take and a lot of chemistry courses in second year, full on organic chemistry and things like that. Lots of lab work, right? Yeah. But with the electives, the way they structure, they really give you a lot of space to like explore to the point that at one time I had nothing to take for an elective, and I took an elective in foundations of sports coaching. Had nothing to do with any of it that I was doing, but because it was fun. So that's the beauty of that sort of system that I really like. They really give you space to explore, because if I were to do it in Europe or if I were to do it back home in Bosnia, the way it goes is you start neuroscience and you only have neuroscience courses. You cannot go to different courses, different degrees, and take electives. So really, when you graduate high school and you're 18 years old, you're kind of expected to know what you want to do for the rest of your life, which at that point I thought I knew, but then obviously looking at me now, I didn't. And I do think it's a bit too much to ask 18-year-olds coming straight out of colleges and high schools to, okay, this is where I want to study. How do you know at 18-year-old, what do you want to do? So I love that system because it gives you that sort of flexibility to explore, and if you don't like it, you can switch and things like that.
So, I actually, I really agree with that. I think it's a discussion I've had on a podcast before, particularly with the episode with Dr. Poppy Gibson, around like the way the educational system, particularly in the UK, works. And it mm-hmm. really is kind of like, okay, you legally have to be in some form of education until you're 18. And I think there's so much pressure to be like, pick your career now. Like, and I tell students now, because, you know, we do modules on this type of content, around, well, think about what job you'd like. I always say, look at the job spec, read the job spec for a job that you'd like, and work back. That's the only way you're really going to be able to figure out what skills they want. Whereas, like, I feel there's a lot of pressure to expect, well, pick a degree and just go do it. And we can make that joke that, you know, psychology is the English degree of our day. You know what I mean? When I was going to uni, everyone was like, if you weren't sure what to do, you'd do English or teaching. Nowadays, it's psychology for some reason.
That's exactly how it was in my undergrad as well. I remember, you know, tons of people that I met, all of them were studying psychology that they didn't even want to be necessarily in the psychology, but they didn't know what they wanted to do. One of my close friends back when I was living in Canada changed her major 4 times. She went from psychology to sociology to history, back to sociology, and then ended up in psychology again. She had to extend her degree for a little bit, but at least the way university was structured, it facilitated that change. You know, she was able to explore that and find her way in psychology in the end. But even with me, that's kind of similar to, I guess, what happened, because when I was picking my degree, obviously I said medicine because that was kind of like what I set for myself back when I was 8th grade, because we did, you know, biology course and I really loved it. But it's interesting what you said about envisioning yourself in a job that you want to do. I guess that's also quite difficult for, you know, people to do it at such a young age. But for me, for example, I knew I wanted to have a fast-paced job, in a sense that it's not sitting in an office behind a computer the whole day. Silly, I say that, and now I'm doing most of that with research, but at least it's like a stepping stone to the next part, you know.
Is not lost on you.
Exactly. But it's also like, I didn't want something super static. I wanted something, you know, fast paced, which is why I did medicine, wanted to do medicine at first, because of the, you know, fast paced environment. And then I switched to like, okay, well, neuroscience. And then when I was thinking about it, going into lab every day and just working, you know, with mice and rats and rodents or whatever it is that I'm working with, and then just writing endless paper on this, didn't really fit me to what I thought I was at the time, which is, again, how I ended up doing forensic psychology, because with forensic psychology, there's so much potential and so many different venues you can sort of explore.
Criminals, that... not like rats. Very different.
Exactly. There we go. And working with humans is just a tad bit more interesting, and there's a little bit of more interaction going there than with rats.
I think that's debatable on the rats and the humans involved. I'm just going to put that up there.
But yeah, there we go. And so right now, again, I'm doing my PhD, and yes, there's a lot of research, but I'm still not 100% sure in exactly what I want to do with this. But I do know that, again, it has to be somehow fast paced, somehow like full of different things to do to keep me interested, at least.
So that brings us quite nicely to sort of the PhD then. I know you can't go into like specifics for science-y reasons and for that kind of business, but can you give us an idea of what you're actually looking at in your PhD and how you're sort of finding it? Like you made the famous joke of, I'm in my third year, so I should be finished sometime next year. Can you tell us a little bit about how, like, firstly, what the subject is, as much as you can about that, and then sort of like how you found your PhD experience?
Yeah. So when I was doing my internship, I was doing a lot of clinical forensic psychology, so a lot of clinical work. But then I did know, based on my courses that I took and the experiences, I really wanted to do something related to sort of investigative psychology, aka police. So I did my topic on investigative interviewing. Again, another course that I took in my master's. Then I was like, oh, okay, this is what I want to do in my life.
How many courses have you done?
In what exactly?
Because like you've gone, okay, I've done this degree with like a big title, and then you've gone, but I did like 20 different things underneath that.
Oh no, when I say course, I mean modules within that
that's
course.
Still like an awful lot of like knowledge.
I mean, my master's degree had, I think, about 20 courses that we did in 1 year or something like that, maybe a little bit less, but there was quite a lot. And there was a very big range of courses, or I guess subjects available. So from, you know, doing expert witnesses and testimonies to investigative interviewing to then, you know, working with young offenders and therapies. So really there's something for everybody to pick out.
For context for listeners, I did my master's in health psychology here in the UK, and I think I did like 7 modules. And you're like, I could do 20. So...
Well, some of our modules were a month, some of them were most of them were 2 months, and then some of them were a month, and then they would change. So we had 3 to start with. We started with investigative interviewing, eyewitness testimonies and things like that. And then after 2 months, they changed. So we did that over a course of 10, 11 months. So then they had space to actually fit them all in. And then you have a full year of internship after that, where you actually get to utilize the skills that you've learned in the clinical context.
Imagine getting to use the skills you've learned in academia. What a time to be alive.
I know. I was perplexed when that happened. Honestly, my clinical internship was such a bizarre experience, because I got there the first day. I was like, okay, somebody's going to have to teach me what I have to do. No, it was, here you go, do it. And I was like, but I don't know how to do it. I was like, yes, you do. Just start doing it. And I started doing it. I was like, oh, look at that. I actually can do it, because I learned this in school. My mind was blown away. But yes, indeed, we did learn enough things to help us, to actually allow us to work. And I was like, wow, is this what happens? But I guess it is. So yeah, when I was doing my clinical internship, I did my master thesis on hostage negotiation and personality. And from there, I got an idea to do it in investigative interviewing, which is, again, the topic of my PhD. I really loved the idea of looking into interrogation / interviewing of suspects, because I loved what I've learned about how it's done in the US, and also how it's comparable to the UK. And the fact that I was in the UK really was a nice way for me to actually start looking into that. So the main topic, and the main thing I'm actually researching, is looking how the personality of an individual, in this case, a police officer, impacts their ability to conduct an investigative interview with suspects. And what I mean by interviewing, I'm assuming most people know, but for those who don't, is obviously I'm referring to the interviewing that happens in custody in the police station when somebody has either been arrested or voluntarily brought up for questioning after some certain crime. And it can happen with suspects and witnesses, but my research is based on suspects mostly, or only, I guess.
See, Emma's listened to this show before because she needs to explain something. See? top tier interviewee, let me tell you.
There we go.
But so, yeah. I'm kind of interested then with this, because obviously that sounds really rad, in my opinion. That sounds really cool. So you're interested in the personality of the person doing the police interview, so the police.
Yeah. Right?
This is a difficult question to answer, so I apologize in advance. But how do you kind of operate within that when, particularly in the UK at the moment, at the time of recording in April 23, the police are under quite a lot of scrutiny at the moment. There's a lot of internal review after a lot of particularly horrible things have happened with people involved in the police. Do you have a take on that, or do you think that like personality research might help with that in some way?
I think it can help. I definitely think it can help. But I've actually asked the exact same question in my PhD interview. That was the exact same question, and I remember. In terms of the media and the scrutiny, like you mentioned, obviously I'm quite aware of that, but I don't think it necessarily influences my research. Do I think it can definitely help? 100%, that's the whole point. The whole point of doing investigative interviewing research is that you want to facilitate the best interviewing there is, and not in a sense that you want to get interviewers who can get confessions. That's not what we want. This is to get the accurate information to propel the investigation further if you're doing interview, and most importantly, to protect the innocents from being convicted falsely or falsely confessing, which is a huge problem in the United States, and it was in the past couple of decades. So that's the whole point. So I try to, you know, look at it from a very scientific/research point of view and do my research, and then, you know, we'll see how it affects and see what results it gives us and how that can sort of change the way things are done.
Can you give us an example of like the differences in like interviewing across, you mentioned like the US and the UK, because my mind immediately went to TV and something like 24, where it's like, this person is a criminal, we have to point a weapon at them to get them to confess because we need the answers. Jack Bauer, kind of aggressive, gravelly voice kind of thing, compared to like the British mm-hmm. equivalent, which is like, we're going to sit you down, we're going to give you a cup of tea, and you're going to tell us everything we want to know because you've been a very naughty boy.
Well, well, you are not far from the truth, are you now?
Wait, you're telling me that the media portrayals are actually somewhat accurate?
I know, can you believe it? But listen, actually, I do have to give it a little bit of disclaimer. I do not watch TV related to any of the work that I do, which is funny because I did as a child, as a teenager. I loved watching any shows to do with, you know, Criminal Minds and things like that. And, you know, so what did you say, 24 hours? What's it called? Not 24 hours. What's it called?
24.
You just mentioned. Just 24. Then, yeah. Things like that,
another,
I don't watch
another
anymore.
Another classic forensic psych one is Cracker, the Robbie Coltrane drama.
Never
from the 80s. Very good if you want to watch that.
That's the thing. It's very difficult for me to watch these things now that I'm doing, that I'm in this field. So I kind of stay away from it. So I cannot vouch too much for how the media portrayal is. But the main difference between the UK and the US is that the peace model that we have here in the UK, almost said the US. So the peace model, the way it's sort of, the whole idea is to be information gathering approach. So you're not there to convict anybody, to get somebody to confess. You're there to get good information, to get accurate information from the suspect. So whether they did it or did not do it, commit the crime, I mean, you just want to get that information that will help you resolve whatever the issue is. With the US approach, what they use over there is called Reed technique or Reed model. And that's very confrontational, very accusatorial approach. And the whole idea is to get the confession, which is why there's a lot of techniques that are being used that can sort of, you know, get people under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress in that interview room to the point that it happened in the past. And there's so much research done on this, to the point that they will confess, you know, just to get out of that situation, even if they didn't actually do it. The whole Innocence Project as well was one of the things that's, you know, looking at these things and trying to get people who have been wrongly accused to be obviously acquitted and released and things like that. So there's a lot of research to go into this, but that's the core difference. UK has much more sort of, like I said, information gathering approach, much more easy in a way, less stressful compared to the US.
Now, I realize like you're researching this and research is ongoing and stuff, but like, what would your response be to someone that said, yeah, but British police officers want numbers and will just arrest whoever they want because they want to, you know, there are systemic issues here. Like I, you know, touch wood, have not been involved with the law personally, as a suspect or anything like that. But like, you know, police have this perception of being very authoritarian and very sort of like, you know, we know you did it. Like, kind of, how would you sort of argue that point from a UK standpoint?
Well, from the UK standpoint, based on the interviews I've done with the police officers.
Yourself.
Oh.
Hold on. Let me check. Is it a me problem?
Maybe.
There we go. Yeah. Sorry, we're back.
Okay.
The audio bar froze and then it came back.
No worries. What was the question? Oh, yeah. So from the UK point of view, I would say that I've already conducted some of my studies and done the data collection, qualitative data collection. I've interviewed quite a lot of different police officers. And based on those preliminary data and the conversations that I've had.
Yes, we're getting some lit stuff on this podcast. Let's go.
Exactly. there's a lot of, you know, basically what we want police officer do, which is not there to catch anyone, but there to get that information out. And I genuinely do, based on, you know, the interactions I've had, that there's quite a big portion of people who do believe that and who do want to get that. So I think it's already much better, much more improved than it is in the US, in that sense, especially, and again, I can only speak from the interviewing point of view. I cannot speak on like the general policing because I don't have enough information. Do I not know enough about that? But from the interviewing point of view, I think the system is much, much more better, much, much, much better than it is in the US. And it has improved over the years. But the idea is that just because something is better doesn't mean it cannot be better as well. And we cannot be, you know, either further improved. So the idea of my research is to look at some other factors that may have been neglected or not looked at in the past and how they can sort of impact that interviewing. Because one can be trained, you know, the best as possible and can do all these trainings and all the peace models and all these things. But if there is something about them as an individual, something about their personality that is always going to make them super, you know, confrontational or aggressive or, you know, authoritarian in the interview room, then that's something that my research sort of wants to spot and discover. And what are these things that could make somebody worse at interviewing? And if we do find these things, how can we target them in training and, you know, in the recruitment procedures and things like that to, again, improve that whole interviewing process and interviewing system?
Well, dang, that sounds super interesting. I know you said you weren't necessarily sure, but, like, what would the ideal job be for you after this? You know, because obviously we don't know what we're going to find with research. That's the kind of joy of it. But like, what would your ideal job be?
I think, like I said, I want something quite fast-paced and interesting. And the ideal job for me would not be one job. It would be more like it would be a couple of things happening.
Well, in this economy, you'll need more than one job.
But you know what I mean? Have a little bit, like, I do actually quite started enjoying teaching as well in the university. I love teaching. I love things like that, especially about when it's the topics that I care about deeply, like this, for example. So I would I would love, sorry, lost my train of thought. I would love to do a little bit of teaching, but also do a little bit of work with the police in the consultancy positions and training positions, because like I said, the idea is to get it to be better than it is already. But also have a little bit of expert testimony on the side, because that's something I was quite interested in when I was growing up, and I think I still am. It's just a bit at the back of my head right now, back of my mind, because I have other things to focus on, so I'll focus on this when I'm done. And again, on top of all of that, I've done an internship for a full year where I did a lot of assessment and sort of therapy with the in secure settings, and I really love doing that kind of work. So listen, I'm listing everything here and I feel like I want to do everything. One day, one job. But we'll see. Ideally, I do want to work with the police and do practical applications of things that I've done to this point.
Well, you heard it. You heard it here first. Hire Emma. She's incredibly skilled, incredibly talented,
Exactly. Here we
and
go.
willing. Willing.
And willing. And willing. Moved what, four countries right now? Ugh.
Oof.
Don't move me again. I'm still happy to move, but I do like UK. I'd like to stay if I can.
Why? The UK is awful.
Listen, it's just they have something to it. Yes, there's a lot of things that are wrong with it at the moment. We don't need to list them. We don't need to mention them. We all know, but there's just something
We all
about it
know.
that I like so far. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, there's still quite a lot of I guess time ahead of me when it comes to me in the UK. I still have at least a year to be here, and then we'll see. Depending on what my opportunities are after the PhD, we'll see if I'll be sticking around or not.
So, while we're sort of on the topic, actually, I'd love to talk about we've talked about your educational journey, but when we talk about that traveler journey, how was that? I think it's very typical, I think, in the UK to be very sort of home based. You might sort of, there's a north south divide. If you're feeling adventurous, you might go to Wales or Scotland. You might have a gap year somewhere. Or a semester abroad. Like, how have you found the different countries you've been in and the different educational establishments?
I mean, first time leaving was probably, I would say, the hardest, but it wasn't the hardest. It was about like the whole unpredictability of it. Because it was my first time flying. Well, it wasn't my first, but it was my first time flying to North America, and
It
I was
was,
not
but it
flying to
wasn't, but it
visit.
was.
Well, I remembered I had like a small flight before then to like for a conference, but I was, when I turned 18, I moved to Canada. So basically, it was, again, I remember 10,000 kilometers away from home for the first time. So it was quite difficult. But also because, again, I moved to a really beautiful country, really beautiful city, I did not have that much hard time adapting, because there was just so much to see and explore. And when you're 18, you're super young and you're starting your education journey, that really helped me to sort of adapt. I did always stay quite connected and attached to my family in that sense. At the beginning, it was also to my country, but the more time goes, the less I feel connected to it. And then in Canada, obviously, I mentioned that at the beginning, I spent 4 years, felt quite sort of adapted there, felt like I found a different home. And then again, uprooted my whole life to move to Netherlands, where I did my master's degree. And that one was probably, I think, most challenging after the initial move. And when I talk about the initial move, I'm just talking about that lead up to the flight to Canada first time. And then those first maybe, few days, few weeks, and then after that, it was all like smooth sailing in that sense. But when I moved to Netherlands, that was I think I took that quite hard, because it felt like I was back at the square one. It was all over again. I already did the move, and I was like, okay, this is it. I did it. But then again, I had to leave all my friends, all my new family behind, the city I've loved and the university that I've loved, to move to a different place. And it was a very, very different place, because I moved to Maastricht, which was a very small city in the south of Netherlands, compared to Vancouver, which is a quite big city and also surrounded by bigger cities and things like that. So adapting to that new city, new environment was a bit challenging for me. And I always talk about this with my friends and things like that. I hated the idea of having to make new friends again when I moved, because meeting new people is easy, but really becoming true friends with somebody is not always easy. And it's not, you know, it's not always, it doesn't always happen. So when I moved to Netherlands, I remember for the first few months being very like, oh, I'm not going to hang out with anybody because I know I'm going to be leaving in a year again and I cannot do this to myself anymore. So I was like, yeah, I'm just not going to hang out with anybody. But then two of my friends did have different ideas and they're like, no, they took me by the hand. I was like, no, you're going to hang out with us. And so I'm really close friends with both of them now. I'm in the same field. And all that being said, again, do it again and move to the UK. So that was the third time doing it. Then the pandemic hit, had to go home for about a bit, and then came back and again did it again. So at this point, I am tired of moving, let me tell you. So please just keep me in one place. I'm happy to travel around the world and, you know, experience new places and cultures and all those kinds of things. But I do not want to be moving anymore if I can help it.
You mentioned a really interesting point as well. It's something that I feel very passionate about. And like, making friends as an adult is really hard, right? Because the majority of your time you spend around people is in work, right? And everyone is there to do a job. And you might get on with people, but those people have the entirety of the rest of their lives that usually they're pretty excited to get to at the end of the day outside of work. And I think, like, yeah, you very much suffer from proximity bias with adult friendships.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, you're great friends with them while you work with them in the office. Then as soon as someone leaves, the relationship just kind of naturally degrades a little bit, right? So I think it's a really interesting point to say that, like, I almost don't blame you for being like, I'm not gonna put myself through that again of trying to make friends. It's so much effort, so much heartbreak.
And it's also at the beginning. Do you know how many times I had to be like, hi, I'm Irma, I'm from Bosnia. What are you studying? Oh, yeah, I did my undergrad here or there. So many times I had to do the exact same introduction, like, you know, the little icebreaker introduction to, honestly, at this point, I feel like it's been thousands of people. And so many of those are just, you know, kind of like chit chat that you had at the beginning that it's not going to amount to anything. And let me tell you, at that point, I was just exhausted. I did not want to do it. I did not want to do any, you know, mingling and ice breaking with anybody. I was just like, anybody leave me alone. I'm just here to do my degree and then leave. Because exactly what you said, it's so difficult to make friends as an adult, especially when you're out of university. At that point, I was still in my master's degree. So even just by mere proximity, you end up becoming friends with the people who are in the same course as you are. But outside of that, and that was especially the case when I moved to Liverpool for the first time when I did my internship, because it was no longer university setting. You're, you know, basically a working adult in that sense. And then meeting friends was adult. Again, big finger quotes, was absolutely impossible. It was just so difficult to do it. So over time, I realized that best way to meeting friends as an adult is finding common interests.
I also resonate deeply with much of what you said there. And I also think it assimilates with so many other things. I think it'd be broad sweeping to be like, that's just how we meet people online these days. But, like, I feel like you could take most of what you've said and make that about, like, any online interaction or online dating or anything like that. You just get tired of having the same conversations with people to the point where people like yourself and I just go, I can't be bothered.
That's the thing, and it's like, it sounds a bit weird when you say it that way, but I want my interactions, my friendships, my hangouts to be interesting. I'm really tired of, you know, empty conversations in that sense. Like, give me something of substance, give me something we can talk about that's not just, you don't know, you and I had this conversation a couple of weeks ago and how, you know, social interactions or friendships have become a little bit bland in that sense, and people are sort of,
there's a really good Father John Misty quote that is to binge on radiant blandness that really speaks to this. They're just like, we want is the same blandness because we know it and it's familiar.
Yeah, exactly. But it's familiar, but familiar has always been boring to me. I mean, I wouldn't move, what, 4 or 5 countries in my life if I found familiar to be comfortable. So, yeah.
Okay, interesting. That's great. We've covered a lot of we've nearly covered as much ground as you have geographically there. That's great. To sort of shift focus a little bit then, let's talk about what you like to do when you're not in work. What is, because you, I mean, you're working seemingly quite a lot because, you know, PhD problems. What do you get up to when you're not on the clock, if you will?
Well, I mean, I just talked about having, you know, friendships and friends that, you know, you can bond over common and mutual interests. So
I'm hoping you'll not have a long list of common interests.
Oh, no. All I do is lay in bed and look at the ceiling, and that's all I do. What boring. That's not boring. Obviously, I'm kidding. On my free time, I love to read a lot. I used to read. Well, I do still read, but I had 2-3 years period of time where I read books one a day because, you know, I just had a moment.
I had a moment for a few years.
Okay. Had a moment for a few years where I just had to consume books like I was eating them. I have, you know, calmed that down a little bit. But what I do, I love a lot of playing board games with friends and playing the, obviously, the TTRPG, which you are quite familiar with, things like D&D, which is probably through which I met most of my friends right now that I'm quite close with and that I quite bond with nicely. So I guess when I'm not working, I'm either reading, playing board games, or playing D&D with my friends, and occasionally, you know, watch movies. But that's quite rare for me to do by myself. I need to be with somebody to watch any sort of media, which changed a lot. I used to be quite avid TV and film watcher before pandemic. After that, I can only do it if I'm accompanied by another person.
Must be accompanied by a responsible adult at all times.
Exactly.
So what kind of stuff do you like to read? Because, you know, reading is such a vast field. There's so much you can read. Mm-hmm. What are you into? What Goodreads recommendations?
Well, not so much recommendations about the books.
To get to know you or something like that. You know,
oh, God, no. I cannot do that. I cannot do that, Chris. That is one answer I refuse. Oh, sorry. One question I refuse to answer. Well, I'll tell you the recommendation is to explore different genres, because that's what I found out in my last 3 years of binge reading everything that exists. I'm a sort of one-track minded person sometimes. If I find a genre that I like, I'm only going to read that genre.
Person doing a PhD in a very niche topic has one-track interests in a very specific way. Might go down and follow those for a long time. Never.
Do you see what I'm saying? Personality is a thing. There is truth to this.
Is it trait? I need to know.
Exactly. I mean, at this point. If I find a genre that I love, I'm going to read that only. And that's what happened to me a couple of years ago. I rediscovered fantasy genre that I've kind of not been into for the past couple, like, you know, through my undergrad, I've read most different kind of books and things like that. And then I rediscovered fantasy. And all I did for a year is read fantasy books, which was great. But then it gets tiring after a certain time, especially when you read in such huge quality or quantities and huge amount, you kind of need to bring in something else into it. And I was quite reluctant to do that at the beginning. I was like, one genre only. So my biggest advice to everybody is broaden your genres, because otherwise you're going to get bored. So right now I'm reading everything, and I'm just mostly right now reading the recommendations from friends, because in the past few years I had a list of books I wanted to read, and I read those books, and people would recommend it. I was like, sure, I'm going to read it. And I, you know, forget about it now, because I'm not so much, you know, I don't want a specific book or a specific genre. Now, whatever somebody recommends to me, I'm going to read. And it's a nice way to discover different books.
So I think you hit on a really, like, interesting way of looking at things. So I think there's two problems here. One is reading for pleasure when you're in academia is quite difficult, because most of your day is spent reading. So I think it's really important to have something that you enjoy reading to keep that love alive. I think it's also interesting, like, how did you start? Because you can look at any retailer for a genre, right? But there's so much choice. How do you pick? I think one of the things that, like, maybe it's a me thing, but I would feel really overwhelmed looking at just a genre and trying to pick something. One of my friends actually recently said they tend to read stuff from, like, the young adult section, because, like, in certain subjects like fantasy, it just tends to get for lack of a better term, very explicit, and just gets more focused on like inter-character intimacy than other things. So like, yeah, by removing that, it's actually a better quality book. So how do you kind of, you know, pick a genre? What choices did you make? Did you ever? I'm realizing I'm asking about 5 questions here. How did you pick something just from a genre when there's so much choice? And did you ever sort of start reading something and going, this is dross, I'm going to just pick up another book?
Yeah, so I started reading in pandemic. So I remember, well, it sounds like I just started reading in my life. I've read before.
See,
obviously.
I was trying not to laugh at that, and then you made the joke for me, so.
I just started reading 2 years ago. No, obviously I read before, but it was mostly academic books and nonfiction books and things like that. And then before that, it was crime novels and lots of classic literature as well. I really had a period where I loved classic literature, especially Russian literature and Bosnian literature and things like that. But those are quite heavy reads sometimes, especially the classic literature. So if you're doing some heavy reading for work, like academia and PhDs and things like that, that can get a little bit mentally taxing. And I started reading in pandemic because obviously there was a lot of, broadening my genres in pandemic and rediscovering fantasy genre. And I started, again, by friend recommendations. And basically, I have a friend who is actually quite an avid reader in that sense, and she was recommending me some books, and I was always like, yeah, sure, I'm going to read it, but I never actually did it. And then I remember on January 1st in 2021, it was a first time I ever made a New Year's resolution for myself, and I was like, I'm going to read 50 books this year. And I've started by, you know, reading whatever she recommended it to me. And then from there on, when you read a little bit at the beginning, even though, like you said, it's quite a bit intimidating to start, you kind of get a sense of what kind of reader you are. Do you like plot-driven books? Do you like character-driven books? Do you love, you know, third-person writing, first-person writing? So these kinds of things you kind of get to know about yourself when you get into it a little bit more. And basically, that's how it happened. And also, I gave myself a goal. And when I give myself a goal, I'm like a person possessed. So instead of reading 50 books, I ended up reading 112 books because, you know, 50 books, what is that? Who was I making this such a small of a challenge? To the point that I was reading just to meet my challenge, which, again, is not the greatest. It worked for me that first year because there was so much that I kind of missed on in the years that got published. But then the year after, I had to lower it a little bit because I was like, okay, this is getting now too much. And are you reading to, you know, meet a goal, or are you reading for pleasure? So there you go. I don't know if that really answers your question, to be honest.
Goal setting, an almost compulsive need to achieve goal.
Yes. Here we go. We're getting to the
You're doing a PhD, right? Yep. Tracks.
There we go. Oh, Chris, so, you're exposing me here. But you know what? That's what we are here for.
So the springboard off this then, this is a question I love to ask people who read, is like, do you have a cutoff point for if you don't like something? Because, I mean, it sounds like you'll just read it to say you finished it. But like,
yeah,
is there a point where like, actually, I'm not enjoying this, I'm going to can it?
Oh, there is, 100%. In that first year, I've only didn't finish one book. And then I came back to it later and I actually ended up loving it. So I just believe that there's honestly some books that you're not in the mood for. So in the first year, I kind of was reluctant to do that because it's like, if I start something, I have to finish it, even if I had to force myself through it. But then after reading so much, I realized, well, this is a bit, you know, pointless, because why am I, there's so many good books out there in the world and so many books to be read that I could live thousands of lives. I wouldn't be able to read them all. So why would I waste my time reading something that I don't like? Which again, started adopting that, a mindset, and it's much easier now and it's much better now because then I don't have to force myself to read something I don't like. So I just either leave it, pick it up for later, or if I absolutely hate everything about it, I'll just give it away or I'll stop with. But there is definitely a point. I do give myself 100 pages, to be honest, before I decide. If by 100 page I still not into it, then I'm gonna stop it then.
Okay, that's fair. I think
yeah,
I think for me, it is there's too much choice, right? It's like any media nowadays, we're overwhelmed. There's too much choice.
Yeah.
And I would say I predominantly read sci-fi dystopia, relatable. I've read like some other stuff in like the horror genre. I'm reading the Witcher series. That's sort of like fantasy. I'm sort of making my way through those over the course of a year. I've got like the latest Final Fantasy book, like Twin Past, is it? I'm gonna whip it out.
I love showing books.
Just find my card holder. Got two pasts. So like this, a novel about two
love
of the
a good
characters
cover.
From the Final Fantasy
Love
VII
a good
remake.
cover.
Because you know I'm indebted to that game for many reasons. And I've been reading a bit of like literary fiction as well, which is quite an interesting genre because that is like here's normal people doing normal things. And like it's not sensational, but like it's gritty, I suppose is the word I would use, and I quite like that. Controversial question as well, actually.
Those are scary.
What are your opinions on audiobooks?
Oh, I don't use them myself because I cannot, you know, keep attention to things like that. Like I have to be involved. I cannot be doing something, but audiobooks are books, just any other book. I don't know. Don't really know if that's controversial. Maybe I am controversial by saying that, but I've
there
seen
are people who
discourse
would say that
online.
They're not, but like
oh,
it's not
I've
reading.
seen. I've seen online discourse online, there we go, but in person as well, saying that audiobooks don't count. And it's a very silly concept to me because you're still consuming the exact same content. And also, in a way, it's a bit discriminatory because people who can't see and have vision
Hello.
problems and can't, exactly, and can't read, and then you use audio, are they not readers? Same as their, you know, able-bodied people are. I mean, it's a bit silly discourse to me.
I think it's helpful, because you hear the words be pronounced, which I think is really useful.
And that too.
And
that
also,
too.
Like, some are really, like, well-performed, more than, like, my brain would imagine the characters' voices. So I think in some ways it's an enhancement, particularly if you look at something like an autobiography that's read by the author. You
yeah,
get so
yeah,
much more added to
exactly.
It.
But it's the books are about the content and about what they're telling you. It's not about am I going to see it or am I going to hear it. I'm still going to get the same content. So it's the same kind of with translation. So like, are you supposed to read every book in its, you know, original language because that's how it should be read? Like it's a, I don't know. I mean, obviously, to me, audiobooks are as good as ebooks or paper books or whatever it is. As long as people are reading for their own enjoyment and not as a pressure to anything and are doing it in any way they want, that's all we want, and not, you know, feeling like you're policed by somebody to read in a very particular, specific way. That's just silly.
Clip it, ship it, that's the stuff. That's the
there we go.
That's the quote, that's the pull quote.
Exactly.
Do you have any recommendations of like things that you think people should read that you thought were really, really good? Or that you really enjoy, because something being good and being enjoyed are different,
yeah,
in a way that's a discourse thing.
Oh, that's a very big difference, I will say. I've enjoyed a fair share of, you know, books that nobody would consider to be, you know, well-written or good quality, but there's something about them.
Sometimes trash can just be delicious.
Exactly. I mean, we all know the concept of junk food, so why not concept of junk, you know, books? But I am a bit always wary of saying that because who is there to say what's trashy book, what's not a trashy book? You know, tastes are different and writing styles are different. Say
so,
it.
So
what
you,
you want.
So, well, you make an excellent point though, right? Because you use like junk food, but like people talk about like trash TV, and this gets into the. I feel like this fits within the spectrum of art versus entertainment, and like some TV is not art; it's just entertainment, and that's not a problem. It's not bad. Sometimes you just want to sit
That's
and watch
true.
Something and not have your brain be challenged, right? But if your preferred media is to read the words, you still should be able to read something, and I'll use a word you used before, like, you know, something that's not taxing but still enjoyable. And my go-to example for this is, like, smut. Sometimes people just want to read something smutty because it's fun. It doesn't have to be, like, intellectually stimulating or artistic.
That's the whole thing with romance genre. So romance genre is the best-selling genre in the world. But the way it's looked upon by lots of people in the society in general is very, you read romance books, that doesn't even count. Like, pick up a classic book, you know, things like that. Those things I've heard so many times growing up, but also now in this day and age where you should already be sort of like, you know, evolved past that point to shame people for their interests. But romance books are, like I said, most consumed genre in the world, best-selling genre in the world, but they're also not considered real literature. And I think the issue with that is that it's mainly mainly consumed by women and by female audience. So there's a lot of a bit, you know, misogyny, a little bit misogynistic attitudes that go into that. And why a fantasy book written by, you know, George Martin and Game of Thrones is, you know, much better than a book written by, I don't know, a female author in a romance genre. I think there's a lot of sort of sexist attitudes when it comes to that. Which again, I agree with what you said, you read what gives you joy and what gives you enjoyment, as long as, you know, you're not sort of promoting harmful content in a way that's, you know, actually harmful. So yeah, I'm a big supporter of read what you want and don't let other people tell you that what you're reading is trash. Like, if that gives you joy and that gives you, you know, peace of mind and, you know, takes your mind off of work and silly life that's happening, then that's great for you. So who am I to judge in that sense?
So I think I'm going to say this, and I'm going to use it within this playful context, but like snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan has a series of novels that are like London gang crime dramas that like are, you know, very gritty and involve snooker for no apparent reason, but of course yeah. They do. And like, it's not like the quote unquote best written thing ever, but it's really enjoyable. I can't put it down. I want to keep turning the page. Yeah. What's going to happen next? This is exhilarating. And like, it is it, you know, high quality literature, quote unquote? Possibly not.
No.
Do I enjoy it immensely? And can I put it down? Also no. I've read books that are fantastic books, quote unquote, that are boring as flip.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. And it's sometimes it's just the way things written. If we write things in a complex manner using fancy words, it's already considered to be quote unquote smarter. If you write things in accessible way, in a simple language, words that are, again, accessible to everyone, it's already, you know, in less quality. And I
Listen,
find that
don't
to be
come
a
on
bit...
my podcast and attack me like that, okay? Okay, that's
hey,
too far.
Listen. I mean, Chris, you got a great thing to get on criticism. I'm kidding, obviously. But again, I mean, this could be also from the fact that I'm a non-native English speaker. So for me, using sometimes big fancy words is not going to make me, you know, like the material any much. So I don't know. It could be because of that. But I do think that it's just the way some people look at the books and look at the content and the quality. It's just a bit sometimes with, you know, holier than thou attitude, and I really don't like that, because the worst, you know, one quote I've heard recently, and I have no clue who said it, but I've seen it like on Twitter and things like that, saying that the worst kind of person is the one that makes you feel bad for your interests, and I really stand by that. So
gatekeeping, right? Like,
exactly,
which we can use to springboard onto TTRPGs, but
yes,
I'm aware you were reticent to try and recommend any books. I'm aware you were desperate
I still didn't do it. I'm so bad at it, because the more you read, the worse it is, because you have more choices. So,
what are you reading? What are you reading presently, then? Just what are you reading at the moment?
Right now, I'm generally not reading anything because I've had a very busy month of April, so I haven't picked up any books yet. I will, and I'm not sure which one. I'm quite open to the recommendations. The last book I read was a book given to me by a friend, which was called, I think, Dangers of Smoking in the Bed, which is a series of, it's an anthology of small horror stories, short stories, which I found to be really, really interesting and well written. But I can tell you that's the last book I read. But in terms of recommending anything, I don't know. If I do remember by the end of the podcast, I will definitely share.
Well, spoiler for later, but books come up later on, so we'll see.
There we go.
So TTRPGs, then, gatekeeping can be a fun segue into that.
Yes.
What are they? How did you get into it? What do you do? Mm-hmm. What do you like about it?
So I always wanted to get into it, but I didn't have an opportunity. I always did love board games and quite complex board games, cooperative board games, basically all sorts of things. So I knew that my next step from the board games would be the TTRPG, or in my case, it was D&D, and still is predominantly mostly D&D. How I got into it, invited by a friend to join for a one shot that accidentally ended up turning into a 1.5 year long campaign. So just started because I wanted to learn, because I love the idea. I love the idea of being in a fantasy world. Like I said, love fantasy as a genre and reading. But what I really loved about D&D particularly is that you got to be in control of your own character, of your own story, and you can be as creative as possible. And it's a really great way to explore that creativity without having to write. Because for people who don't have really good writing capabilities, especially writing for novels and books and stuff like myself, but also people who have a really wild creative imagination, again, like myself, D&D was a perfect sort of midway point between wanting to pursue that creative and, imagination, inspiration, but also not being able to write. So here you go. Here's a D&D. Just act like you're in a fantasy world and do whatever you like. I really love that. So I don't think I'll be stopping anytime soon.
That's great. So I think it's like it is just that you are a fictional person or creature in a fictional world. You just kind of roll with it, right? How did you find, and this is one of my favorite sort of questions, is how did you navigate like the math? Because I feel like a lot of people look at like a D&D character sheet and go, ugh! And that like I mean, okay, let me frame this another way. How accessible to new players do you think D&D is?
Well, I do think it's quite complex at first. See, I didn't mind it as much, but also I started playing with two quite ex three actually quite experienced players. Two of them have done a lot of GMing, DMing before. So where we started with them, they were really good in integrating us into the story rather than just being like, here's the character sheet, you pick everything for yourself. It was more about, they didn't really put any emphasis on pick the stats or pick the correct spells or correct weapons. It was just like, let's roll and see what you get. I'll just write it down. It's not that big of a deal. The idea is to get you to introduce to the world and to how it works. And none of us knew that we were going to stick with those stats for a year. And it was still fun, even though one of my friends had -2 on almost everything, because he rolled really badly. It was still super fun to play the game. But I do agree with you that it's quite inaccessible maybe for new players at first, because a couple of my friends in that group really struggled at first, well, still struggle to this day with the mechanics of the game. But it also, I don't think it needs to be simplified in any sense. I just think that it's important to have a right person to start playing it with. So somebody who is experienced and somebody who can guide you through it at the beginning while you learn on your own way. And I also do think watching let's play kind of things, Critical Role and things like that online really can help you to sort of see how the game can be played. I say that and I never watch it because I cannot physically concentrate on something for so long, but I do recommend it to other people if they can.
So I think it, as well for me, what I would say is if you're interested in TTRPGs, firstly check out another episode of the podcast with Jen Kretschmer,
Yes.
TTRPG player. They are incredible, big fan. Really glad I still got them on the show. But I've got to plug myself. I apologize.
Of course, go for
But
it.
like I think for me, once you got past that initial reading of like characters and like what job, like job class, to use other RPG words, species and things like that you've picked, it really is actually you only need to get that initial set of stats and everything else kind of autofills itself, and really all you're ever doing is rolling a d20 and adding or subtracting a number from that. And I think if you actually explain that to a lot of people before, it would be a lot less intimidating. I think one of the issues with the D&D sheet is that there's just several tables of numbers for every type of activity. Like, I would like to talk to this squirrel. Okay, roll me an animal handling check. And it, like, essentially, unless you're a druid, you're never gonna actually ever use that. Like, you're never going to need to do an animal handling check. You know what I mean?
I agree with that.
I can hear the community being like, but what if a bard wants to sing to a squirrel? Or, like, other instances where animals would be useful. But you understand what I mean. Like, a typical player who's just gone, I'm a barbarian and I'm going to smack everything. You possibly don't need to worry about, like, stealth or animal handling, for example.
And I think especially for the first games that you play, so whether they be a campaign or a one-shot, I think it's important to focus more on about enjoying role-playing and seeing how the game works rather than worrying about the stats. So I played two campaigns so far. So I played the first campaign. We did it for a year. I said year and a half, but it's actually a year. And then we started the second one back in October and we're still running through it. In the first one, I was really not worried about the stats. I was really not worried about the spells. I picked whatever was fun, whatever seemed cool, and I ran with it. And I really loved it and enjoyed my time. And in that year, I realized how much I love D&D and I love playing it and I want to continue playing. So when the second campaign happened, I spent 2 months with my friend devising what my character is going to be, building a very intricate backstory, thinking about the spells I want to pick, thinking about the stats and how I want to arrange them after I rolled. So I really put so much more thought into it. But then because I already was a bit more experienced, I already knew what I liked from the game. Because playing D&D as well, what I find is that depending when you pick, there's so many different sort of, you know, roles you can be. One of my friends hates anything to do with magic and she hates playing mage. She hates playing, you know, anything to do with spells. So she'll always put purely, you know, fighting characters in that sense. And again, which is why it's important to explore it at first, because you'll also learn what kind of character do you like to play and not worry too much about the stats. And yes, having a person who can actually guide you through that really nicely is helpful.
And you've also played a little bit of the 2D20 system in the June Adventures in the Emporium.
Yes. Yes, which was very different, but very interesting as well. I think that one is definitely much more user-friendly at first because you have two dice and you have, 10 stats in total and three items, and there you go. I think for maybe the beginner players, Dune in that sense is a really nice one to start with and then kind of continue with D&D, because one thing I did struggle a lot at the beginning, and I did talk to you about this as well, is that you go from a very complicated D&D system that once you get to know, you actually really like. And then you go from Dune to you have two dice and you, like, no hit points. Like, how do you play a character with no hit points? And things like that. But again, I think it just has to be switched. You start with this one and you can sort of build your way to it. And there's obviously lots of different variations of D&D that you can do that people do where you only play like with, you know, a few dice rather than the full system.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that, like, I plug that because we actually play Dune together. That's why I kind of mentioned it. But I agree. I think
should have mentioned that.
It's a lot more user-friendly because you're only ever looking at two numbers, adding them together and trying to roll under it, basically. Yeah. And I think that's very much... Because, you know, I had this discussion just the other day, and it was like, why do I need seven dice? And I was like, really? You only really need a d20, and you might roll any of the others for an attack? At most, generally speaking.
But if there's no fighting, all you need is a d20 mostly. Because if you just do it in a, you know, role play with no fighting, then the other dice are not, you know, necessary in that sense as well. And it also depends on what kind of, because I remember when we do one shots with our group right now, when we need a break from the campaign, I remember our DMs always ask us, so do we want exploratory session or do we want a fighting based session? Because obviously there's very different ways of playing the D&D. So if you want to start, you know, easily, you can just do a little bit of exploratory. And what I really liked about the world and D&D itself is that there's so, like I said, there's so many different versions of it now. One of my friends has got the, it's like a baking, cooking manual or something for D&D, where the whole idea is that you're baking something and that's the whole campaign. And I'm like, I really love this because I don't need to always be fighting the monsters. Just give me a cake to bake and I'll be happy. So, you know, things like that.
I can now not stop thinking about like Cooking Mama D&D edition. Where it's like, let's roll a d20 to see if we crack our eggs properly. Yay!
Yes! See, why not? Why not start that to get people introduced into the system? It'll be fun. And at the same time, you could be making the actual cake on the side. Why
Now
not?
you're playing with portals. Let's go.
Now I'm playing.
But
But
no,
yeah.
I think TTRPGs are really fun. I think more people should give them a go. I think I
Yeah.
agree. You got to find like a world that you enjoy. That's one of the reasons I picked up Dune was because like I really like the world.
Yeah.
How did you find picking up that when like you had like little knowledge of the actual universe itself? I'm not just doing this to try and get a positive review myself. I'm just curious because we were
No,
playing with
of
a couple of
course.
other mates
Yeah.
who were like, had read the books or at least seen the film. Like, how did you
Yeah.
find that?
Yeah, so for context, obviously I have not seen the movie or the films or read the books, even though I really want to. But not knowing anything about it was actually in one way really kind of fun and really made me as a player and as a character very unpredictable, because we had a couple of incidents where my character really did things that she shouldn't have done canonically, because that's not what, she should be doing. But because I didn't know it, me as a player was like, oh yeah, let's raise hell because this seems fun. So I think it creates really fun moments for me and for the group as well. That happened in D&D as well a lot, because D&D has a lore in its own, and even if I was quite familiar with like the fantasy lore and fantasy genre before from the books and stuff, every obviously the lore is quite like slightly different and quite different in some aspects. So when I started playing D&D as well, there was moments where I would do something and you would just see my friend, oh God, no. So I enjoyed playing Dune for that, because you could just, wing it on the spot and do whatever it is. It is sometimes difficult, I think, at the beginning, because you don't know what you're supposed to be doing. But once you crack that ice, I think it just becomes even more fun. And I really liked getting to know Dune lore throughout playing, rather than just going and reading the books and watching the movies. Obviously, I think that's quite an important thing as well, and something that I still have yet to do, and it's on my plan to do it, just no time. PhD again. But getting to know a lore through a slightly different way than before was actually really interesting. And not to again give you a shameless plug here, promotion, but you did a really, really good job of leading me through it and leading our group through it. So yeah, I mean, it has to be, otherwise you need to have a good GM, and I've been lucky enough to have good GMs and DMs in all my TTRPG experiences. So
Do you
that's a
think that
big part.
you're ready to pick up the mantle yourself and lead a game?
I think I could be able to, but knowing myself, I would overthink it. I think overthink it in a way that I want it to be so interesting and so perfect and so intricate that it would make, psych myself out. No pun intended. I think I could do it, but I actually just enjoy playing a character much more than I would enjoy, pulling the strings in that sense. But I definitely do think I will like DMing at one point.
So, out of interest, would you go for something completely sort of homebrew, something you wrote yourself, or would you crack open a module to get that
I
sort of
think I would crack
experience?
open the module at first just to know how it works and it can lead you through it. I think I would add my little twist like here and there, just to make it a bit more personable to me, or like, my style kind of thing. But definitely would start with the module, and then if I'm more experienced at it, then I would do a homebrew 100%. And the big bad guy in the end would be a giant pigeon that the entire party has to defeat. Because yes, I have a thing with pigeons.
I also want to point out for listeners' clarity that Emma's style would just be chaos. Utter
Yes.
chaos.
Utter chaos. That is how I play, and this is the motto I stick to. Just pure chaos. I love it. That's how I go through life. That's how I go through TTRPG as well.
Rule of cool. Rule of cool.
Exactly. Exactly. Which hence the big bad pigeon.
The big bad pigeon. I can't wait to do battle with the big bad pigeon.
Big pigeon, BBP.
BBB.
I'm gonna. Anywho.
I like to always throw a little couple of blue sky questions at my guests.
Okay.
And one of them is, if you had no limitations, you had full access to budget, resources, people, time, what project or thing would you do? We've had answers from like specialist research projects to opening up like a business and all things like this. But what would one thing that you just love to do if you had the time and money to do it? So it doesn't have to be research. It could be like the world's biggest game of D&D, but like, you know, whatever.
Well, I've always, when I was younger, when people asked me, what would you do if you become a billionaire / millionaire? I always said I would open a giant, massive farm that is just for, it's going to sound sad now. I mean, it's not sad, but a giant, massive farm that's for all stray dogs and cats and abandoned animals that I have sort of encountered a lot growing up in Balkan region in Bosnia. So the whole idea was always to have this giant, massive space that all stray dogs or stray animals can be housed in with, you know, volunteers and amazing little play pens and a little education centers and adoption places where people can kind of adopt and play and things like that. This is very simple, though. It's very plain. It's not a very fun answer, but this is what I've had since I was like 10 years old, that I told everybody that I would just, you know, create a massive center for animals. Because what I've encountered throughout my life, whenever I tried to volunteer at the shelter, every single time I got a response, we have too many volunteers. My response was always, how can you have too many volunteers? If the doggy walks two times a day and by two volunteers, well, if there's another volunteer, then they can play for another time in the day. And so my idea is going to be, there is no limitations. There can be as many people as they want to be there to play with the dogs. And, you know, I say dogs, but I mean all stray animals. So there you go. You did not expect this answer, have you now?
It's a great answer. I love it. And obviously, like, because you have unlimited resource, it could be massive. You could afford to pay all the volunteers.
Exactly.
I would love to get paid to play with stray animals. That would be great.
Exactly.
Be a great weekend for me. So that's really sweet. I loved that we went from like, yes, I'm a chaos demon in D&D, to I'd open up a home for stray animals.
I just want to protect all the dogs. I mean, you asked me a question that I can actually give you five different answers right now, but I picked the one that I knew I had from before. Other ones would be basically, like you said, one massive D&D campaign in the whole world, but not the things like that. Just creating centers that are quite, you know, comfortable to people.
Having a
bookstore / board game / D&D / I don't know, a dog cafe concoction.
Okay, all right. The Irma Center for Stray Animals / board game cafe. So everyone,
yes, there we go.
Everyone sits around the table and plays D&D, but they have a stray animal familiar that sits with them.
Yes. Yes, there you go. See, Chris, you need to be, I need to partner up with you.
I'm not just a pretty face / podcast host.
Where are these unlimited resources you were talking about? Come on, let me see them. Let me see, I'm waiting.
They are on the other end of that rainbow.
Yeah, oh my goodness. But there we go.
If you find them, let me know.
Oh God, you will be the first to know.
The other question I like to ask, and this sort of like came through sort of doing the show, but is there anything or anyone you'd like to give a shout out to? Because we talk a lot about like journeys and how you what you're doing, and not a lot of the time people focus on why. That's, you know, why I principally do the show. I feel sorry for anyone who ever actually like listens to these in order. I can't imagine anyone binging my podcast, but I say a lot of the same crap episode to episode.
I mean,
sorry if that's you listening to this right now. But, you know, like, it's. I think it's great to give people the space to pay homage to anyone or anything they want to. Is there anyone you'd like to give a shout out to?
God, so many people. I feel like I'm accepting a reward. I'd like to thank my family and my friends for supporting me.
I'd like to thank the Academy for this award.
Yes, I will never forget it. It's a very good question. I don't know. I don't think there's a particular person in mind. Because I don't want to single out anybody in that sense, but the people I'm lot of us are also from psychology, how we met each other, doing PhDs or doing some other clinical work and things like that. And everybody quite has a certain way they do it and why they do it. So I just like, I wouldn't shout out anybody in particular, but just all of my sort of friends and people I'm surrounded with that are in one way trying to make this world a better place. It's not always easy and it's not always super straightforward process, but I do pride myself on that I surround myself with people who do want to do that. So I don't think there's one person I wanted to give a shout out to.
What a wonderfully wholesome and yet diplomatic answer.
I know. That's my specialty.
Like, yeah, all my wonderful friends. And if you're listening, that's you. And if you're not, well, you'll never know because I didn't name anyone.
Exactly. Well, if they're listening, they know who they are. Come on. I will make them listen.
Okay.
An hour and a half of your talking in their ear. That's all I want in life. Come on.
I mean, who wouldn't enjoy such a thing?
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Oh God!
We spent like the entire day in each other's company the other week. That was fine. That was lovely.
It was fine. Exactly. We don't see each other for a few months because of PhD, and then spend bam 24 hours constantly.
Top tier. So as we wrap up, then I like to do a fun little game where you are going to a biome of your choice for a remote getaway. Everything you take will you with will magically work for reasons. It'll have internet connectivity and power, all those sorts of things. You'll be well fed, there'll be shelter and all those sorts of businesses, right? But you are only allowed to take with you one from each of the following categories. So one film, one album, one book, one video/board game. If it comes as a collection, like physically in the real world, you can take that. So, like, you take a box set or a collection of books, like the entire Witcher collection. I've already mentioned that. Yeah, what are you taking?
I hate this question. This is so difficult.
I send all my guests the questions in advance.
You did, and I saw it, and I did think about it. I was like, oh, I have an answer. And now it comes up, and I was like, I don't like that answer. This is the thing. One thing you need to know about me, I'm a very indecisive person, and I cannot pick top of anything. Like,
sorry,
it's difficult.
How many different degree subjects did you go through? You indecisive.
Exactly.
Never.
There you go. Exactly. So, okay. So start with, which was the first one? The film.
Film or TV show. If you can get it on.
For some reason, I didn't. Yeah. I think for the film, I would pick, and I know this is a very cop-out answer, but I would pick Lord of the Rings Extended Trilogy. We can add on Hobbit to it. It's fine. It's not the best, but it is good. It's fun because grew up with Lord of the Rings. Love that thing. I don't know. I have no plans to get married in life, but if I did, I did say one condition is that it has to be Lord of the Rings themed. So I would bring that as my movie.
So I would, I know you just said you had no plans too. You could just do it with a party, by the way. It doesn't have to be a wedding, but
there you go.
How would that theme go? Like, I just would love to probe that. Like, how would the
I had everything envisioned when I was 14 years old. But now I don't remember. Well, obviously, whoever's the ring bearer has to be dressed as a hobbit, has to be Frodo. The officiator, whoever that is, would be Gandalf-styled character.
I'm available Gandalf for bookings.
There you go. the bride, or the guest in this case, me. But you know what? I'm happy to organize this for somebody else. It doesn't have to be for me. We'll be probably dressed Arwen style from...
Yes, Irma, because you need yet another career.
I mean, why not? Wedding-themed wedding organizer, here I am. I love organizing things. And things like that. The ring, the wedding ring was obviously going to be one ring. Yeah. The engagement ring will be the Nenya, the ring from the Elven ring. So all of these things, Chris, I had this all envisioned. I actually had it written down when I was 14, but now I forgot because I, again, no plans to get married myself, but I can do it for somebody else. So give me a shout if anybody needs a themed wedding party. I'm here. I'm your girl.
You heard it here first. one album. What are you taking?
Oh God, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I was thinking about this. I saw this question right before the right before the podcast, and I lost all my. Well, I will say I quite enjoyed. Am I going to go with the favorite album ever? Because if we're talking about my favorite album ever, it would be The Wall by Pink Floyd, because I grew up with that album and I absolutely loved it. And I love how it tells the story throughout the album. But I don't know if I would pick that. Did you say I'm going on Abandoned Island?
So it's to a biome of your choice. I wouldn't necessarily go for a tropical island myself, I'll be
Oh,
honest.
so I can pick where I'm going.
Yeah.
Oh, that is interesting. Let's go. I'm not going to pick a favorite, but I'll pick recent album, or I'll pick actually Without Fear by Dermot Kennedy, which is Irish artist that I'm actually seeing on Monday with our close friend Beck, who was already here on the podcast
last
month.
Check that out.
Exactly. Last episode, check Beck. She's lovely and wonderful, and we're going to see him in a concert. So I would pick his album right now in this moment and bring it with me to whatever biome of my choice, apparently. Would be, oh, I know what it'd be, snow and ice and cold and me in a small little cabin with my dogs. That's all I want.
Sounds so beautifully Bob Ross. I love it.
There we go.
Just
okay,
include a happy
question.
Little mountain and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Mountains have to be in the back. And there we go.
This is. I'll tell you what. I'll give you the book one last to give you a little bit more time to think about.
I cannot.
It.
I'm just gonna skip that one. I cannot bring
you
one book.
No skips. No skips.
I can't. Chris.
One game, video, board. Like, what are you taking?
I don't do video game. I would bring a board game, and I would bring. Recently, I started playing a new board game, which is called Taverns and Tiefenthal, and it's basically you having a little medieval tavern where you serve beer to your customers. It's such a wholesome game, and I love it. So maybe I will bring that, but my favorite game, favorite board game to play actually has always been Eldritch Horror, which is very, quite extensive. And that one you can play by yourself, and I have actually played it by myself. So maybe I'll bring that one instead. Because for Caverns of Tiefenthal, I need somebody to play with. And if I'm going to this imaginary, perfect, heavenly place on Earth, it's just going to be me and nobody else there, except for some animals, maybe.
Okay. And the book.
Here we come.
What one book? You can have a collection. I'll give you a collection. Like, if it's like a set or a series, right? But what are you taking?
Give me
You've
a
got to take
second.
Something with you.
I've got to
genre,
take something with me.
Any size, any language, but you've got to take a book.
Well, does it have to be something that I've read before? Because
oh no, it can just any book of your choice.
Okay, see if that in that case, there's a lot of books I want to read that I haven't gotten through yet. There's a book series that I've heard really good things about. And if I'm going for this winter theme that I've already listed, you know, this winter wonderland, I'll pick a book that goes well with that theme. And it's called Winter Night Trilogy by Catherine Arden. And it's apparently inspired by, I think, by Russian folklore, and has a lot to do with mythology, like Russian gods, old gods, things like that. I don't know. I haven't read it. I don't know if this is good. If anybody who's listening to this has heard it, please do let me know. But this has been on my TBR for quite some time. And it's apparently set in winter and it's a very wintry book. So maybe I will bring that to keep me company to finally read this trilogy. And it's actually three books in it. The first book is called Bear and the Nightingale, I believe. I don't know what the other two are called.
Okay, that sounds legit to me. There we go.
Oh my god, this was more stressful than doing any exam I had to do is picking a book that I'm bringing with me. You cannot put this pressure on me. Come on, not again.
And again, for listeners' benefit, we've had this episode like scheduled and rescheduled, I think, at least twice now. You've had access to these questions for well over
a month.
I did.
I've changed them three times by now because I did not really look or prepare any questions except for these ones because I was just scrolling. I was like, oh, this is easy. That's fine. We'll talk about it. Oh my God. One book, one movie. Are you crazy, Chris? But here we go. We got through it. That's all that matters.
Okay. And then I like to turn the tables on myself for my own amusement and like to ask if you got any questions for me. I have had the pick one of the each thing a couple of times. I've been asked about my PhD a couple of times. So I'd recommend steering away from those. Was there anything you'd like to ask me and get me answer it on record?
So many things. If you were to live for the rest of your life as one D&D class, which would it be?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I'm gonna cheat. I'm gonna cheese the answer though.
Same as me. It's okay. Go for it.
And just say like a cleric, so I can heal myself whenever I'm sick.
Oh
like
God! Oh come on! You could have picked anything, and you want to heal yourself, Chris? Where's the adventure spirit?
I'm currently ill, so that's where that reasoning hit.
If I
was gonna cheese it, I'd be like, I'd go super cheesy. I'm really gonna add some extra cheese, and be like, I'm gonna play a cleric. I'll be a dragonborn because they're cool, but I'll be a psychomancer, the subclass specially designed by Take This to help heal mental health challenges and acknowledge mental health.
Oh, we love that, don't we? love that. Go for it. Meanwhile, I picked a character whose whole point is sowing fear into people's minds and defeating her enemies in that way. So go figure. We are very different people, apparently.
We're juxtaposed, who realized? I think it's worth saying that I've only actually played, I think I've played a ranger, a rogue, and like that cleric like subclass like a couple of times. So I actually have a lot that I need to do. I think being like, you know,
yeah,
a wizard or some type of mage would just be cool, generally speaking, because magic
be amazing.
Dope. You know what I mean?
Except warlock, because you do not want that deal. Trust me.
You just said like you're a real world warlock, like IRL.
Like I'm real world warlock.
This deal.
You don't want this deal. I'm playing it in my second campaign now, and it's painful. But there we go. And that's a lovely answer, though. I do like cleric, and I do like the psychomancer idea. It's just very you, so I'm not surprised. I love it. Thank you for answering that, Chris.
You can see my little psychomancer just there for those watching, sit on the top of my shelf.
Yes.
So
adorable.
You know what I mean? Quickly, just another random D&D question. What's the highest level you've played?
Actually, only 7. Right now, last campaign we did, we started from level 1, ended up in 7. Right now, we're at level 7, and according to my DM, we're going to go to 13.
Because I'd love to do, like, just a level 20 one-shot, just, like, where everything's just
massively... Oh, that would be amazing. To be fair, one of my DMs recommended we do a kind of, like, epilogue to our first campaign, or this campaign, with all our characters, whoever survives, I don't know, 10 years later at level 20, and then do like a one shot, which I think would be really great to revisit the characters after the campaign has ended.
Yeah, that'd be fun. And that's the thing with like TTRPGs is that like, and again, maybe I'm speaking for myself, but like of the limited play I've had, I become like attached to the character. Like they are a being,
oh,
and they've
100%.
Got like their set of math rocks that you roll, dice for those that don't speak the lingo, and like, you know, that's them, and it's they are a person that you play, and they kind of exist in of themselves.
Yeah.
And like I love the idea of like returning to them, like when they're like, you know, older and wiser and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like doing an episode.
Yeah. It would be amazing, wouldn't it? But also, like, whenever I talk about my character or my playing, I never say I did this or I do this. I always say she if I'm referring to my character, because to me, she's like a very separate entity to me. And it's like a whole, you know, kind of like reading the book. You get attached to the character. Same how I'm attached to my character. And also the fact that I'm in control of her was a bit terrifying, let me tell you that. Because, like I said, chaos demon. I have a tendency to get my characters into situations that it's difficult to get out of.
other fun little question before we do wrap up. Should we, like, do you...
I started level 1 in my first campaign and I really didn't think anything about it. But then we did the second one and started level 3 and I did enjoy level 3 much more. Again, for new players, I think level 1 is fine. But for more experienced player, I will always start with level 3. I level 1 is okay, but like you said, for somebody who's done it already, it's not super fun to do it at level 1.
I also think if you're playing basically like a non-magic class, it's actually really like there's just not very much you can do prior to level like 3 or 4. Like I first played a rogue,
mm-hmm.
and like, yes, I'm going to fire an arrow at it is all you can do, because you and basically don't have any abilities.
Basically, exactly. So I agree.
All right, well, with all that done, where is the best place for people to get in touch if they like the episode, and the links will be attached to wherever you found this?
Yeah, so I'm not actually anywhere on social media in that sense, except for my private stuff, which is obviously not for sharing. But if people want to get in touch with me, it does exist. If anybody wants in touch with me, I think either to university profile, my email, or LinkedIn, because I do not super active on LinkedIn in sense of posting, but I do communicate with people through there. So if you need to get in touch with me, that's the best way to do it.
So that's,
and one day I will make academic Twitter. One day. But it shall not be this day.
Will it be before Twitter implodes? Who knows?
Probably not.
So, you know, whether you want to talk about forensic psychology, you want to hire Emma for your latest TTRPG campaign, Lord of the Rings wedding planning, hit you up on LinkedIn.
Or if you want to give me resources to get my big animal farm ready, also here for you. Those unlimited resources Chris talked about.
Yeah, if you have those, let us know. But yeah, all it remains is to say goodbye and click over to the ending screen for the video portion. So,
thank you very much, Chris.
It's been great.
Thank you for having me. It was amazing. And yeah, hope people enjoyed this podcast.
Bye bye, everyone. Take it easy.
Bye bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps. Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy. Look after your mind, body, and soul. And I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye-bye.